This is a production of Cornell University.
It is 12:18 now, Wednesday, February 2nd, meeting of the Employee Assembly. Are there any late additions to the agenda?
We have the trustees report from Beth.
Yes. Add that in there.
I don't know if you want to send it,
but
well, I guess the diversity committee will cover the
civility. That's right. Yep. Okay, so jumping right into business of the day, Linda wanted to talk a little bit about the faculty and staff assistance program. Give us an update on that after she's done chewing. Sorry, I put you right on the spot.
Okay. So I'm sharing this, I don't want to say confidentially, but kind of because we haven't now and made any.
So do we need to not?
That's a good question. Well, you know what? If someone listens, good.
Okay.
Good for them. That would be impressive. At least we know someone's listening. So it has been communicated across the HRV. So that's why I think at this point, you know, we didn't say, oh, don't tell anyone. So maybe they have. But before we started thinking about going out and announcing it across the greater population, Peggy and I, who are on the communication team for this change, felt really strongly that we wanted to move the EA in very early. So for those of you who are aware of how our Faculty and Staff Assistance Program has operated in the last couple of years, what happened a couple of years ago is the program was really put into three components. One piece was the crisis manager piece, which thank you very much, you recognize that there. And that's for after-hours crises for employees, 24/7 coverage. And then we had two other pieces. One piece is a 1-800 line that was operated, has been operated, is currently operated by a vendor out of Esalen, New York. And that number was really for employees to call 24/7 for personal life crisis situations. And as part of that service, they can get referred to three counseling visits to a counselor close to their home. The second piece of it was kind of the piece that had been operating, but we kind of refined it a little bit more, which was some on-site counselors that we had, and those counselors were supplied to us by Family Children's Services, have been supplied to us by Family Children's Services downtown for many years. And we currently have two of those counselors, and more of their focus over the last couple of years is really helping employees through workplace issues. So they do still occasionally, I say, you know, if an employee comes and wants to talk to you about something personal, don't turn them away. The last thing we want to do is turn away someone who is in need of help. But the bulk of their focus has been really working with HR folks more and with employees that are maybe having problems with their supervisor or that are referred to them by their supervisor, referred to the counselors by their supervisor. So what we've heard, and I've been working very closely with Gannett over the last year, and there was kind of something put out to us, like it's been put out all over the university, that they really wanted us to take a look at. We had similar functions and that they've been providing mental health services for the students. We've been providing mental health services for faculty and staff. And they said, just take a look at that. Take a look. You have this affinity. And does it make sense for you to collaborate more in some way to provide a better service to the university overall, much like that's being done all around campus on many other functions? And so for this past year, we've really been looking at it, and a couple of things have come out. You know, number one, especially in times of crisis, we have realized that it's very hard to segregate students over here in their mental health crisis and what's going on, and then segregate faculty and staff here, because many of the things that happen affect everybody. So if something happens to a faculty member, they've got many students who work with them that are going to be upset and need help. So that has become very apparent, is that we're not this, you know, community of silos. We're a community, and as we're facing community mental health crises, it really affects multiple constituents in the community, not just, you know, one group or another. And the second thing is that most people are just completely confused on who to call at this point. So those two things have come out very clear. And so I've been working very closely with Greg Yields, who is the director of CAPS, and We came to an agreement in the late fall, and we've just been working through budget issues, to not continue our contract with the vendor we've been using on Avestol, the 24/7 vendor, after the end of the contract, which is the end of June, not to continue our contract with Family and Children Services, but to transfer the service over to Gannett. And so the faculty and staff assistance program will be run out of Gannett, but there are some things that we felt were very important. One is a very different physical location, because we could not possibly have a student and a professor, their professor, sitting in the same waiting area if they had needs. So we are going to reopen the offices that existed at one point in time in College Town, because the other thing we've heard is the counselors are currently sitting in Day Hall, and there's many people are very uncomfortable with that. So College Town is an easy access, easy walk to. So we're going to open. Gannett is going to actually hire three positions. The current counselors that we have are more than welcome to apply for those three positions. They'll have a director who will see people, but also be doing a lot of interacting and trying to understand what some of the bigger issues and needs and concerns from a mental health standpoint are. There'll be one person who will full-time be a clinical seeing people. And then there's a second position, which is similar to a position that CAP has, that's called the CCI position, which is really someone who will be working very closely with the colleges and units, their HR people, to help them with kind of bigger trend things that they're dealing with. And we'll also go and probably do what they call let's talk hours in some of the bigger units that want that. Geneva is included in that, by the way, and the model. Is we'll probably have at least a day a month or a part of a day a month in which somebody will actually go up and sit in Geneva. So, and the other thing is that they are going to offer a 24/7 service, so an employee will get a live voice. That's one of the things we had heard as a complaint in the new, in the current service, is that they get this menu and, you know, they have to kind of go through this phone tree before they finally get to someone. This will be a live voice 24/7. And the nice thing is when there are crises that occur, it's very difficult when you're responding to a crisis to always think of every single piece. And there's been a couple of times where maybe on the faculty and staff side, we could have been a little bit better and quicker about alerting the student side that this had happened and there might be student impact, and vice versa. Now with it sitting in one place, those things won't happen. It will be this complete, full community mental health approach that will always happen, because everybody will be at the same table hearing the news at the same time. So we really think it's going to provide a better kind of mental health strategy for the whole campus, more unified. And we think that it will be better for the employees to in setting it up this way. So we wanted to share that with everybody. Some of the things that I'd love to hear your thoughts are best ways to communicate this. One of the things we really want to know, or let people know, is and when to communicate this, because the changeover is supposed to happen as of July 1. And I know sometimes when you communicate too early, it confuses people, because that isn't in effect yet, but we also want them to know as of July 1 this new service is coming out. And any thoughts that you may have about it, that, you know, questions that you have, we're going to create a fact sheet on it. Anything that you can give us that will be helpful so that people understand it, are comfortable with it, and know how to get help. Because I know right now it's been very confusing for people for the past couple of years. Tanya?
So just one thing that I want to put out there, because I hear from a lot of people when I say, oh, you should go talk to, is that they feel it's not confidential at all.
Yeah.
So what? Is it... The faculty staff assistance program is not confidential, and it gets back to, if you go about a work problem, that it eventually winds its way back.
Really?
So whether that is perceived or whether that is fact, I don't know. So maybe you can...
Well, all the counselors are licensed counselors, so they are bound by the law for their license.
Mm-hmm.
The only condition in which they would disclose is the same condition any community
right.
counselor would disclose, mm-hmm. which is a situation of harm. That I think that's a really good thing to make sure people are aware of, is that is the confidentiality that they can be assured based on that. Okay, I think that's a really good point, because I think that's a lot of the reason why people don't do that
right.
and may go to a community resource before they would go here.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a question in terms of reporting structure. So if this is going to be part of the MEC, is this going to be reporting to the Dean of Students and no longer HR?
Well, we're having a service agreement. So they are managing the program from a clinical standpoint. In terms of some of the things that we're putting in there is that in terms of programming, in terms of trends and things that we need, and in terms of if they're considering any kind of change in service offerings or anything like that, they still need to liaise with human resources. So there's still going to be a dotted line in between. And the director will still attend all of our monthly meetings and human resources to ensure that there's that connection there, because we think it's really important that connection stays there. We are creating a service agreement that they're providing the service to us, much like Family and Children Services did, much like E&I, the vendor we use down in Bethel, have. And that's really what the relationship is going to be.
And what about in terms of funding?
The funding is coming out of benefits pool, the same way that the faculty and staff assistance program funding almost has.
But it'd be kind of theoretically blended in that.
Yeah, well, as they have the expenses, they'll submit the expenses, which will come out of the pool in the same way. And they're following, this is a budget neutral move. So we're not going to be, we're not going to be incurring additional expenses. In fact, we're hoping maybe even to be able to allocate money to be able to provide more services for the same budget, better services for the same budget.
And then my last question, because I just know that UMet's still overwhelmed and understaffed, even with the new hires. Is there any guarantee that these new hires are going to be solely purpose of staff and not students? Not to say that students don't have the issue, but you don't want them to become a backlog, because I know right now there's a 2-week waiting period for students to go to UMet. And I don't want that necessarily to be created by, like, well, we got these new staff, and now they're going to go report to students first because they're a priority and not the staff, and we have to pay for it.
They are sitting in a completely different place, and they will be maintained very separately. I should also mention that one of the things that we're doing that is something we haven't been doing that I think is a huge improvement is a new medical record system. We have one right now for the students, so they're creating a completely different system for faculty and staff, so it will be completely separate. And in fact, and Gannett, by the way, I believe is going to be recruiting a couple of new counselors too. So there's going to be kind of a blanket try to bring people in, but we're specifically looking for counselors who've had experience with EAP programs, because the needs and the concerns that faculty and staff have are typically much different than students. And so we are looking for people that have that experience and can be able to have information and knowledge on those kinds of life issues more so than the students. So they're going to specialize in different ways. So yeah, could they help a student? They potentially could, because they're a licensed clinician, but their expertise is really going to be more on faculty and staff types of issues, and we're feeding them completely separately. So no, unless there was some major catastrophe on campus where everybody was pitching their hands in all across campus, that would be the only scenario in which I see that happen in that, So the answer is no, there will not be, there might be cross-learning that happens, but there will not be cross-clinical visits or anything that's happening between the two.
When you first started talking, you were talking about also the crisis managers. Where does that fit into this new formula?
Well, we're having a meeting with Kenny Hall on Friday to figure that piece out. Because we're trying to understand whether it makes sense to continue the crisis management and the function separate the way we have, or whether it makes sense to take a look at combining them. So we're going to try to figure out the details of that, and this Friday's our first meeting to go through the details of that. We're trying to be extremely planful, and we're talking July, but we're really making sure that we're getting all the details figured out very early on, because we don't want to have anything slip through the cracks. That's a very good question. So, please, if you can think of anything else, one of the things that I put out there was this very large report, and so because a lot of the focus has been on the new website and electronic communications, of us really getting out there to the groups who do not use electronic communications regularly. So we're going to be looking at ways that we can, set things up at time slots as well, and possibly piggyback on some bigger team meetings that might be happening, particularly in marketing areas where there's less computer usage. But if you have any other ideas or thoughts on that, we would really, really like to know. And if you have any thoughts on timing and you think it would be best to introduce it to the community, where it won't be too far away from it that it doesn't make sense, but close enough that people, you know, I would love to hear any thoughts or feedback you have on that.
Do you know when, maybe, you know, just a thought, when, like, 9-month employees kind of go off contract and maybe try and put it out right before they leave? So, you know, I'm thinking May or something like that, where it's in advance and you're catching everyone while they're still on campus, but it's maybe after things calm down a little bit for a lot of units.
So maybe May-ish.
I wonder if it also makes sense to just have a teaser sometime in the spring that just that change is coming. Look for more information in May or something like that, so that I don't know how many people would pay attention to it, but it would be just be one more way to let people know that it was coming, but not to give them much information,
right?
Because
okay.
That's the part that gets confusing.
Right. Once they get the details,
then they start looking for it and they won't be able to find it, and that'll get frustrating.
And, you know, I think it works very nicely with that HR has been starting to partner on Notice and Respond.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's, you know, more and more our partnership will be closer and closer, because we really, what we really stood back and said is we really want this to be a community, a caring community approach. And to do that, having it together in one way will really help to continue to facilitate that from happening. So there may be an article that will come out in the Chronicle sometime probably in the late spring that will talk about the overall mental health strategy and approach for the community, with this being a piece of it.
I think it makes a lot of sense, having worked with staff who were in need of support and not being able to navigate how to get to the right people. I think this will make a lot more sense.
Yeah, and we are looking for one number. We may not right away have one number for all mental health, but that's what our goal is to have one number that people can call for the more time, to figure out who to call. Right now there's two for faculty and staff, and that's definitely going to be reduced down to one. And then maybe down the road we may do one number for anyone with mental health needs.
And I'm assuming you'll probably get this into the Notice and Response. So
yeah, we're working on that right now.
Other questions?
So if you have any more thoughts or questions or anything, please let me know, and I can, if you want, update them as we start to move up closer to it. I'm happy to give updates too.
Good job.
Next thing we want to talk about is we had said we wanted to have a spring meeting in Geneva.
Oh.
So I don't know if anybody's given any thought to that. Gemma, I don't know if you kind of have any ideas, since we'd be coming to your home.
Well, we could do we could have our meeting and then a tour.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be great.
Like a wine tour? That's what I was
thinking. Well, we could arrange for you to stop on the way back.
Let's rent a van. Have a meeting.
Hire a driver.
That could be Tanya.
Yes, I could drive. Oh, there you go.
Hey, Gemma, it's Gary. So I think, you know, in addition to a tour, it'd be fun to talk to some of the folks up there, like that guy who helped devise those new Apple brands. What's his name?
Well, that was Susan Brown with the New Varieties.
Yeah. Who helps her?
Kevin Maloney.
Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, that place is so nuts and bolts and wonderful, and it's like, you know, people are up there doing real work, and it's just interesting to talk to. Yeah, and you know, you guys know what I'm saying. I hope that. I mean, even just talking to like Kevin or who's the guy with the seeds, Kyle Arvin.
Kyle Arvin, yeah.
Just really, you know, just to get a tour, but also like be able to talk to colleagues and they're so proud of their work up there, as they should be, and there's some real cutting edge stuff, especially like the guy with the apples is interesting.
Absolutely.
How long were we up? How long have we been up there in the past?
Half a day.
Half a day, counting travel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We got an hour each way. I would really like to have like the tour to last 2 to 3 hours, and for you guys to meet different people.
Mm-hmm.
And then our regular meeting.
Last time we went up, had the meeting with lunch,
and then had a tour afterward, and we left by around 3:30.
So you went up at 11?
Roughly, yes. And we probably had about, I don't know, 10 or 15 Geneva people sit in on the meeting, which was pretty good.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah, we invited the staff to see if anybody wanted to come to our meeting. We can do that again.
Yeah. Would we get transportation from here, or are we in charge of our own? Maybe the carpool, obviously.
Yeah, we carpooled last time, but, I mean, there's always, you could always look at budget and stuff. Yeah.
How many acres are up there, Gemma? Like 700, I'm guessing.
It's around, I think it's like 750.
Yeah.
Do we want to look at our meeting schedule and see if we can pick a narrow down a meeting or two?
Would it make sense to look at spring break? Would that be easier on people's schedules? Do we meet that week? I'm not sure.
No.
No, we don't.
How about for you, Gemma?
Well, I was just thinking to get you out in the orchard. It'd be good, like,
how about
weather.
For May.
Yeah.
May.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Get some nice blossoms on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
For the end of May.
So the 18th is the last May meeting we have scheduled.
The present's coming.
Okay, so the 4th?
4th, maybe? May 4th?
Yeah, let's do May 4th.
Yeah. Okay.
May the fourth be with you.
Stop, Gary. I started to write what you said.
May the fourth be with you. Okay.
That's perfect.
Okay.
Okay.
Tanya.
Oh, she will be back. She had to get a phone call.
Gotcha.
So I can't do a report from the chair. Well, I guess I can, because I was at the meeting. Anything else about that, about the Geneva trip, Gemma?
I think that's it.
Okay.
I'll coordinate it and then get an agenda for everybody.
Perfect.
When it gets closer.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We can skip to the minutes. Sure. How about we skip to number 5, approval of the minutes? I thought that Beth was not there. At our last meeting, but you have her a coming.
Yeah, and I came, but it was really late.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah,
you did.
Yeah.
Check out me.
Because I remember Beth sending us an email saying that she couldn't come to the last meeting or to this one, and I don't think she can come to the next one either.
Okay. But I will fix attendance on that.
And I think Jason should probably have a chance to look at the communications committee report to make sure that, not communications, sorry, the cell phone. Because I wasn't paying careful attention, but I don't remember what he said. Does anybody remember whether this was accurate?
On his new cell phone update?
Yeah.
The old policy was that you had to track personal use.
That's what I thought.
Right, it's the old policy, but in the new policy you don't have to track that anymore, which means that the guidelines aren't as strict.
The guidelines are what?
Are not as strict.
Not as strict.
Whereas it used to be, you'd have to say, oh, this is a business call, this is a personal call. They've blurred that now because so many people are using cell phones for business and personal that they've kind of changed that rule.
Well, the current policy is you must track personal use on business cell phone.
That was the policy, and I guess the policy change is that.
I thought they didn't change it yet.
That's what they're working on. That's the discussion. We are changing our policy based on change in IRS policy. And we can ask Jason to clarify.
All right.
Any other changes or comments about the minutes?
Do approve.
A second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Yep.
Aye.
Great. We skipped number 4.
I see that. you could have talked about our meeting.
I know, but Amy told me to skip it. She wasn't confident in my ability.
You know,
I'm confident in Leslie's abilities.
Amy's not.
Clearly, you're deficient in your abilities. So, we met with Mary last week, and she was happy to see both of our resolutions that we approved. I guess I made a small gaffe in not copying her on the resolutions we sent to the president. I didn't know that she's either not on actions at assembly or whatnot, so we talked about that, and we're going to make sure that she's on that in future so that I copy her on that so that she's aware.
Well, and I noticed on the last resolutions that we got from the essay, mm-hmm. they had copied people, so they're doing that.
So
we just need to remember to do it.
Right, so that she is in the know, that she is our, what was she calling herself, our
executive sponsor?
Yes, yeah. So we talked about that. We also talked a little bit about the climate survey and her response to that, which we can talk about more under old business. And what else did we talk about?
It was a brief meeting.
Yes, we only had a half an hour with her this time around.
We told her that we were participating in the University Diversity Council ring.
And she thought that was wonderful and appreciated that.
Oh, and we also talked a little bit about our desire to get around to the bargaining unit staff based on the communications report, and she suggested that we needed to talk with Lauren Jacoby before we talk with bargaining unit staff to make sure that we're using the right language and that we're not saying anything that we're not supposed to say to imply that we are in some way
bargaining.
And so Tanya and I are meeting with Lauren and Alan Mittman tomorrow to work out the details, and then we'll have talking points and things to say, things not to say, to share with you guys.
Cool. But that's it?
Yeah, it was brief.
Yes, very brief and very quick. And we also talked a little bit about the George Peter Award with her and putting some more guidelines and information in place. And we talked a little bit about the notion of having some other type of award, not that this is an EA thing, but some other type of award that maybe isn't as formal as the George Peter, but something that would really recognize more staff and the work that they're doing, how hard they're working.
You mean like more than one person? What do you mean by more staff?
Maybe more frequently.
More frequently. So something that is, I mean, George Peter is a very big award, but really trying to get out there. And she's saying, you know, with everything that everyone's doing right now, we should have a lot of competition for George Peter Award. And we don't have a ton of competition. I mean, we have a half a dozen or so, but given what people are doing across campus, there should be more. There should be more people out there trying to say, I've got staff who are doing a whole lot.
And one of the ways that we talked about maybe making that happen is to change the guidelines so that it's easier to submit a proposal for someone or a recommendation, because it may be too cumbersome.
Well, and they don't all need a catered luncheon or champagne or stuff like that.
And so I'll just once again reiterate, encourage people to submit kudos, because if we can get that ball rolling, we can have, hopefully it'll catch on and we can get more people acknowledging that. One other thing I can update on is I had a meeting 2 weeks ago with Paul Bursick and Betsy Schreier to talk about the benefits pool, because we started the conversation last month or so about the lack of education benefit and increases in kind of providing tuition remission if people are taking classes outside of Cornell. So we got into a discussion about what's in the benefits pool, which is almost everything under the sun, things I didn't even realize, like transportation is in there, sabbaticals, the child care grant program, the child care facility, besides your medical, your dental, your retirement, all of those kinds of things. And the cost of the pool is increasing next year. And the rate is overseen by or reviewed by the federal government, because they contribute into it. So there's a fine line between what we can put in there and what they're willing to reimburse for and what they're not. So we try to be really careful about what we put in. We also try to be really careful about keeping that rate competitive, because that can draw faculty to Cornell or send them elsewhere. Because if they're applying for a grant, obviously the more money that goes into that benefits pool, that fringe rate, the less money that they have for their grant. So it becomes very competitive. So we really walk a fine line with that. And there's some concern that, you know, if the rate continues to creep up down the line, and right now we're set until 2012 or 2013, that things may have to come out of what we currently offer. So there may be fewer services. So they weren't very interested in talking about what we can add to. What they did want to put out there, just in talking about the education piece, is that there are a lot of educational opportunities that people can take advantage of. They did say the rate has increased based on TC3 tuition. So that's not great.
Not great,
but it's something, and it is a perk.
Yes.
But you could take classes at Cornell for free. Mm-hmm. They also encouraged the use of the Skillsoft program, which is free. They also talked about the rate for eCornell, which is another program that you could take classes, which is fairly cheap for staff. I think it's like $99 or something like that. So a lot of options to take advantage of if people are interested.
That's new, actually. Mm-hmm. The eCornell thing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great courses if you haven't gotten on and looked at those. There are a lot of great options. I did talk a little bit about staff development opportunities outside of classes, because that's professional development is something that a lot of people are very interested in, and they said that really is kind of up to the unit's discretion and not necessarily something that they could push forward at this point. But an interesting conversation. The best thing that I got out of it is if they do have to make any changes to the benefits pool and what they're offering, that will go to the University Benefits Committee, which EA has members sitting on. Both Linda and Leslie are sitting on that right now. And we will be part of that conversation as to what may or may not go away in the future. Nothing's going away anytime now. That. Anything else I'm forgetting that we talked about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then going on to committee reports, you want to talk about the Diversity Council?
Sure.
Or you want me to talk about the Diversity Council?
So,
by the way,
Lynette. This is the Diversity Working Group. So we attended our first meeting last week. It was an interesting meeting. It's a group of people from all over campus. It includes faculty and staff. And I think it includes students, but there were not students there. Is that true? And our role clearly is to represent staff as they are revising the bias protocol.
Does everyone know about the bias protocol?
Does everybody know the bias protocol? Mm-hmm. So in the late 90s, there was an incident that happened in the residence halls that was bias related, and it led to the development of what's called the bias related protocol that has lived in the residence halls since then. And in the early 2000s, there was a move to expand it to the whole community. It's a way to report essentially any kind of bias, but the protocol itself responds to anonymous bias, because there are other avenues for reporting bias that's not anonymous. So if it's police related, it will go to the police. If it's JA related, it goes to the JA, that kind of stuff. But this is predominantly looking at anonymous bias incidents. So if there's graffiti on a poster, for example, or if there's an environment that gets created in a workspace that feels unfriendly, that kind of stuff. That's probably not anonymous, but it would be reported through this process, and then it would be responded to appropriately. But right now there's nobody who has ownership of the university-wide process, and the way that it's how living in residential programs is, it doesn't have the same kind of life behind it that it did. And some of it is because it was created for a purpose. You know, a specific event happened and they created it, and now it's kind of become diffuse and it's not as
alive as it has been. I think it has good bones. It just isn't being utilized. So there's this desire to create a process that applies to faculty, staff, and students. So all members of the Cornell community trying to stay connected to this. We are all one community. And the council's driving to have it completed by May, this new process that includes going out and talking to people in the community and revising and writing a new process. They're looking at some national models that we could purchase. They've gone and looked at some other schools to see what other schools are doing. And right now it's in the hands of the Dean of Students to draft something that would then come back to the whole committee. Kent Hubble. And he's putting together a group of people who will work on that.
There will be forums held in March for people to be able to come and see kind of this outline and provide feedback in response to it, and then the group will go back and kind of polish the model. But tied into that is, you can kind of segue into why we got involved, is Linda had a conversation with Lynette about civility in the workplace and our concerns about staff and how they're treated, things that we've been talking about. So they're hoping to make it more than just bias, but also civility and respect. Mm-hmm. Whether those are the right words we want to use. But Linda, I don't know if anybody had a chance to look at the PowerPoint that I forwarded from Linda, which you put together, right?
Yep.
Very nice.
Yeah. Linda added the first couple of times.
Mm-hmm. But this is something that we'll be talking about, and I don't know if anybody had any responses to this.
I thought the earlier slides helped set the context mm-hmm. for Cornell.
Yeah, that's
it,
what I thought was really
tied it together nicely.
Well, kudos to Cornell for doing especially in a very difficult political environment.
Right. So if I can just do one quick add-on, because I sent that to, and she's not been mulling it over. So she sent me an email this morning and said, you know, what might be really helpful for the EA to do in terms of this whole idea of civility is to come up with almost rules for civil behavior. So some, and just for fun, if anybody wants to read something kind of entertaining, George Washington created this rules of civil behavior and decent behavior. It's 110 of them. And it's a bit outdated because we don't have things like if you're going to kill vermin, like lice or ticks on yourself, to do it when other people aren't. anyway, but that being said, there are some, you know, the very first one is every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present. So I think, I printed it out because, I mean, certainly there are ones that in no way, shape, or form would apply to today, but I think there's 110 of them, and I thought it might be a nice starting point to just kind of say, well, in spirit, even though the way it's written, you know, isn't relevant, it might be worth looking at, as well as I think some of the examples of some of the uncivil behaviors mm-hmm. that are listed in it from the book that I was talking about. If we flip those around mm-hmm. And say, you know, that's uncivil, so what's the reverse civil of it, that we might be able to do that. It might be worth, if anyone's interested, in a few of us getting together for one of the meetings, maybe coming up with a list.
I think that's
so
good idea.
I just throw that out there, and maybe that'd be something that we can send mm-hmm. forward and say, you know, here's what we consider civil behavior that mm-hmm. should be something every, and we can look at skills for success, because I'm sure there's things in that too. So
I wasn't here for that meeting. I'm wondering about the word civic. As opposed to civil. I know that there were some issues about
respect with
the word. That was the other word. But there's a thing, I'm imagining that the underlying desire underneath that is that we become sort of more of a, that we're more civic minded, I don't know if civic is even the right word, in terms of our relationship with the institution and with each other. And so the idea is to promote a certain kind of public responsibility to the institution. But the lack of respect really denigrates the civic aspect. You know what I mean? So by being conscious of civicness, you are allowing for disagreement, but done on a civic level. That's actually for the best interest of the institution. Is that sort of what's going on? I'm not sure. But I'm just wondering about, I'm thinking about that word as opposed to civil, because that feels personal. Like it almost feels like a critique of someone's behavior as opposed to civic, which is more about the responsibility in a more institutional setting, so it kind of broadens the, sort of takes the onus off of the individual. I don't know if that's helpful, but
yeah, no, I think
thinking about that anyway.
Yeah,
assuming that that's
might actually be very good to be honest.
Oh, okay.
I don't know
who
might also want to, but
okay.
I think that's a good point.
Yeah.
I think courtesy, you made a very good point in the last meeting on possibly exchanging out in considering respect.
Yeah.
You know, in support of the hearing community initially, if we really want to be a hearing community, if we think
exactly.
in that civic-minded way,
right.
I think that will create
that. Helpful. Yeah.
And,
right.
and I really believe the caring community
mm-hmm.
really starts more in the day-to-day interactions you have with each other to
right.
feel like, you know, you are watching out for each other. You are treating each other with respect.
Right.
So if I throw that out there, if anyone is interested, maybe we can put together a small group to kind of come up with something we can mop up to the rest of the group.
Can you email a link to that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's pretty entertaining.
I was wondering if other historical figures like maybe Ben Franklin and the Farmer's Almanac, there may be something in there too, or even Martin Luther King Jr., if he had anything, any kind of similar documents, so you might be able to cobble together.
Right, based on...
quote, it could become quotes from historical figures.
I think we should address tone of voice in there. You could say the nicest thing in someone, but if it's a dry tone, it's
not nice. No, good.
You know what I mean?
Did that guy bless her heart?
What?
Bless your heart. Bless your heart. That's what the southern way. If you proceed it by bless your heart, then that's enough.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and I would say another thing that we would want to put in there is almost an email etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to be civil in email, because you could be shouted at in email or perceived to be shouted at or shouting at someone in email.
And respecting boundaries. You know, boundaries is really an issue, I think, on off campus, and that might be another area to look at. How do you respect them? What are boundaries? How do you respect them?
Yeah.
Boundaries and authorities.
That was the token. EA curmudgeon, I would just say you guys are really biting off a big thing right here.
We are, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, I just throw that out there.
You are a curmudgeon.
So that's one thing I was going to say.
That was
like, you know,
yeah.
I think sometimes.
I'm sorry, Gary.
That's all right. I think sometimes candor at Cornell is misinterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
Candor is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of times I've been to meetings before, people complain about what happened at the meeting instead of saying what they were thinking at the meeting
because mm-hmm.
they don't want to hurt anyone's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, that was my very limited contribution to this.
Oh, I was just being candid when I said
that. I am.
Oh, boy, so
does anyone else want to take Linda up on this kind of little think tank thing? I mean, I'd be interested in throwing some ideas.
I've got a little
bit
of time.
Yeah. Definitely need to know. See what wants to reply about that.
Okay.
Oh, you never know.
Okay,
Celia,
you and
Al
just
have
something
else.
Okay.
Okay.
You want to talk about Benefits Committee?
Sure. Linda and I attended the meeting on Monday for the Yamashi Benefits Committee. It's been on hiatus for a while. And now they're back in full swing as the healthcare reform bill marches on, so they're doing planning really right now because when they have to be ready when it comes into effect. I mean, and chime in here at any point, but basically they're really gearing up for 2014 when everybody's going to be required to have health insurance, each person in the United States. So they're, you know, they're trying to figure out how they're going to accomplish that. There's going to be a, what they're calling a pay or play mandate. So you either have to pay for your employees' insurance or you have to give them a voucher so they can buy state-based state-based insurance, which for some people in certain economic, you know, if they're paid lower, it might be beneficial for them to get their insurance through the state and not through Cornell, because Cornell's might have a higher deductible or a higher premium or something like that. So they're gearing up for that. But what that may mean for us is that we may not have as many plans. We may, our premiums may be higher, deductibles may be higher, those types of things, because they're, what they need to do is not offer such an attractive plan that it's going to fall under our an excise tax in 2018. In that case, we will be paying 40%. If everybody remembers this conversation in our meeting with Mary Opperman, we will be paying 40%.
Yeah, I think the employer, though, not the individuals, would pay 40% on
not the employer contribution. In this chart here somewhere.
Does Cornell's insurance plan spending come anywhere close to them?
Not at this point, but yeah. The way if our premiums go on the increases that they're currently going on.
One of the plans is very close.
One of the plans is close now.
Yeah, one of the, I think it's the 20, the 80-20. It's close to what the caps are right now.
That's
the one that we are contributing most to.
Because it has the lowest deductible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the lowest. And
also people can go to anyone, so it's not negotiated rates like it is with the other plans. It's like they pay 80% of whatever the rate is.
Mm-hmm. Healthy living is the least expensive to us as individuals.
Okay, so tax will be based on premium, not Cornell's level of support. So what does that mean?
That's the combined contribution of both the employee and the employer. So what they told they have both an individual cap and a total family cap. It's like $12,000 for individual, $27,000 for family.
Yeah.
And so if spending goes above that, then anything that is spent above and beyond that has 40% cap on it. Mm-hmm.
Individual and the employer.
The individual can pay the employer does.
Okay.
Well, which will eventually hit us because it'll go up, come out of the pool, which then kick our copays up, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, indirectly we will be impacted. So,
well, they were also saying something about that it may end up on your W-2.
Because it's a benefit.
But right now, so it is gonna, it will show on your W-2 next year. But we won't be taxed on it. But they said at some point it may show up on your W-2, and you will be taxed on it.
Right. Like right now, we're not taxed on our medical contribution.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think if it exceeds. But this could all change too.
Right.
I think that's the important thing. Now could change. One of the things that they think will be likely to change is what those cap rates are. They think that's something that is likely to change. We had consultants were the ones who presented it, and they seem to think that a lot of the major pieces of the plan are not going to change. They felt that little things like the caps would be the things that will see change,
and
they think they'll be raised up.
And they felt that it would pass.
Yeah.
They felt that.
Did they talk at all about the changes in medical savings accounts and stuff like that at all?
You mean like the $25?
Mm-hmm.
The $2,500.
Yeah.
They didn't get a lot into it. There was so much information.
But there would be a $2,500 cap.
Right, which is different than the $6,500 cap that it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something, when I talked to Paul and Betsy, they were really concerned about that, because that goes into effect not next year, but the year after, I think. And so people right now who have a lot of medical expenses can put up to $6,500 a year before taxes into a savings account to pay for those expenses. After that, it's going to knock down to $2,500, which is a huge difference. So they're going to be working hard next year to really tell people get that $6,500 in there and get stuff that you need to have dealt with while you still have that option, because it's going to decrease after that.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is that Cornell is very generous, mm-hmm. and, you know, they do have, we pay, the employees pay 27% of our health care, and the university pays the rest. So, you know, we're very lucky that way. And the other good thing with the health reform is, you know, there won't be, you won't be allowed to deny people coverage for pre-existing conditions, or if you get a condition, they're not going to be allowed to cancel you, you know, those types of things. So,
yeah, there are also, not that it applies that much here right now for us, but there are also changes in the retiree pieces of things that they're working through. And there were two retiree reps mm-hmm. in the room who were very concerned about what some of those things are in terms of things like bridging the prescription plans and stuff like that. So that's stuff that will be coming up in. Although it's not concerned immediately to our employees, none of our employees are getting to the place where they're thinking about retiring. So if these changes happen, it will impact our employees, potentially their ability to retire. I mean, they'll retire, but, you know, at the expense. So,
and like they said, likely anybody, I mean, they were just speculating, they said likely anybody hired after 2015 should not count on health care when they retire.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah, so those are important, you know, and they have more information about the retiree piece of things that are next meeting, which is May, March 17th. Yeah.
Thank you, guys. Beth couldn't be here today, but she submitted a trustee report, so I'll just read that to everyone. This is from the January 20th board meeting in New York City. She says, we are expecting budget cuts. The New York State budget should be out February 1st. We might already know this. Mm-hmm. I think we do.
It was in fun.
Yeah, it was.
12%?
Yeah. And then some cuts to Medicare and a bunch of different things. Warren Hall is undergoing renovations. Cornell will be putting up modular office swing space on the ag quad on the area which is currently a parking lot across from Warren, and that should be there for 5 years. The firm designing the new bridge barriers split, and we had to renegotiate with one of the principals. We are sort of on track, but might be delayed about 6 weeks from our target date of presenting designs to the City of Ithaca. 410 Thurston Avenue, the old alumni house, will undergo renovations. Everyone's looking forward to this multicultural center that will house OMEA, LGBT, Asian, and African American groups on campus. And then she says, good news. The provost reported that we have received 36,273 freshman applications, which is more than ever. But it's lower than every other Ivy, so that's
the percentage increase is
percentage
lower.
Lower, yeah. We hit the $3 billion mark for our fundraising campaign over several years. We still have a long way to go, but we've hit that $3 billion mark. The financial plan that was developed, the cost savings plan, has many parts to it. Everything is tracked as planned, and we're a little ahead of where we expected to be at this time, which is good. Faculty renewal is our next big strategic planning effort. The university will be hiring a lot of faculty, in part because we have not hired recently and because we expect to have more faculty retiring. And they had a good discussion about Cornell's rankings and how differently they are in the different colleges versus one big Cornell. That's it in a nutshell. Everyone is getting excited about the sesquicentennial in 2015. So that's her report. I can't answer anything, but I'm sure that Beth won't be at our next meeting either, but if you have questions, you can email her, and I'm sure that she will be happy to share.
I wonder if we, once in a while, should give Beth something to forward to the trustees. When we get this report out, so mm-hmm. I mean, most of us, or a lot of us, know that have that stuff
right.
already. It's mm-hmm. nice. But I wonder if we should be more helpful to her and just say, you know, next time you're, I'm not even know which committee she's at.
Building.
She's building and properties.
Buildings and
yeah.
properties and finance, I think.
I thought she was on student services, but maybe
so, I mean,
but yeah,
it's more of like a two-way kind of relationship
mm-hmm.
for this.
So kind of like the what the EA's been up to report?
Or you know, I was at the EA meeting on Wednesday and they were concerned about blank, and I just wanted to put that out there.
Respect and civility in the workplace.
they're deeply concerned about this
on
many levels.
I'm sure they are.
Just a follow-up question. Did you ever get a response back, like, should... You remember we were looking at, we were supposed to meet with somebody from the Board of Trustees?
Oh... That was from the
strategic plan. That was it.
And I sent an email to Marin, and she followed up and said that it had been written in error and that they were going to correct. And I haven't seen the corrected version. But there's the external reviewers are supposed to be here next week or week after.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that it's been, the final report's already been.
So we don't have supposed to meet with them.
At the end of the year, we do go to the trustee meeting when they come out to campus, right?
In May.
Yeah, and I give them a report of what we've done, which any one of us can go to, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we don't have someone who comes here.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? I like your idea, Gary. Thank you.
You're welcome. The other thing we can do in terms of reports, if we're ever interested, is I think we could do some real quick hitting hot topic stuff. So, for instance, you know, my colleagues, you know, government community relations is here in Albany, Washington. We're the smallest unit on campus. Between those three places, there's 12 of us, that's including Edmund. But, nevertheless, in really key liaison positions. So, I mean, we could get Charlie Kwasanski from Albany on the phone sometime and just have him give us 5 or 10 minutes on what's going on in Albany in Cornell's interest. He's on the ground there, you know, he'll be battling back that 12% cut to the contract colleges, and you know, is there anything staff could ever do? And I'm probably a little different insight into the kind of nuts and bolts stuff that goes on regarding university funding at that level. Mm-hmm. So I just throw that out there as a standing offer.
Do you want to set something up? That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you?
Sure.
Cool. Thank you. Moving on to old business, so the climate survey, just to give you guys an update, thank you for anyone who gave me any other changes to it. We did bring that to our meeting with Mary, and she appreciates what we want to do, and she did throw out a question as to, you know, why we're framing it as just kind of a written letter to the president, and we're not submitting it as a resolution. And she threw out there, which I appreciated, to say that we can submit it the way you've written it, and if the president says no, the president's going to say no, and that's it. If we submit it as a resolution, if he says no, it's still the same response. If he says yes, and it's just a letter, and where do we go from there? If it's a resolution, we can actually push it forward to say the employee assembly submitted a resolution which was approved by the president, and we've forwarded something and we've created a bigger action.
Right.
So I just want to throw that out there before we move forward to say, you know, I appreciated that comment from her, and it's kind of true. We submitted the letter, and we could say, oh, the employee assembly said this would be a good idea, and the president agreed, versus we asked, and he said yes.
I thought that was always our intention.
I
thought the whole email was just to test the water. And if he came back, like, seemed like he was positive about, and then, I thought that was the first one. Then I thought in the executive committee, it was decided that it wasn't necessary to do it. Because, I mean,
first
the whole,
ask, right.
Yeah, cause, but I always thought the first ask was just to test the water. Like,
right.
Was he supportive? What was his thought? Is even on his radar? And then I thought the whole original intention was that we were going to create a resolution. But we didn't want the resolution to be a simple no. If he wasn't already... Because, I mean, I agree. It had a lot more weight
mm-hmm.
with the resolution. But I also think it's important, because that's our only power is resolution, that we at least understand that he's supportive of it before we create it. Because, I mean, it wouldn't mean anything, and I think it would be a very big setback for him to say no to a resolution. And that's why
it's not a resolution. Huh?
Well, I mean, when did he say no to one of our resolutions?
He said he's got to give a formal response to a resolution. He can't just say no. He said, right?
He could come back and say, I appreciate this, However, we don't have the time, the money, the whatever to do this. He could write back and say, this is great, but this piece isn't realistic. Modify it. Or he can say, yes, this is all great, and move forward. So I think what Mary was saying to us is, instead of putting it forward as a letter and then he's going to respond to it in some way and then putting together a more formal resolution basically saying the same thing, we should just forward it as a resolution and he's going to respond in any one of those same ways, but it's not kind of then a redundant thing.
Right, because if he approves the letter, then we have to go back to the resolution anyway.
Right.
So we may as well just...
Well, I think the letter is getting longer, though.
Getting longer.
I mean, it was getting longer than what our original intent was.
Right.
I mean, because I thought our really original intent was just like, we're thinking about going forward with measuring the climate survey. Has there been any discussion within there? Because, I mean, I agree with Mary about the redundancy, but also I think that it's very important that we have knowledge of what his intentions are about before we just set a resolution. Because I think that's really the only formal power we have. And if we get a no or something, I think that would be a setback.
Who's writing the letter?
I wrote it, and it went to EA members, so it's gone through that, and I could forward it back to you.
And do we know who would... Your climate survey, if it was approved,
we recommend institutional
research. Here's the I got the first draft.
The core group, I was actually a member of the core group that was originally going to do the survey. So it was myself, it was Marnie and Marin from institutional research, it was Lisa Nishi from ILR, and Chet Wazowski was not here anymore. So we were actually tasked with that originally 2 years ago. And we decided against it because at that point in time we were concerned that we thought it would be great to know what people were feeling, but we were concerned that because there were going to be changes that were happening down the road, that if people answered in a certain way and then their unit happened to be one of the units that were affected, that they would associate having responded to the survey with the changes in the, and it would have totally destroyed any trust that existed on campus at all.
Sorry, the reason I was asking that was just I want to offer, I'd be happy to help convert that letter into a resolution, and if somebody from institutional research and planning hasn't already been involved in talking about that letter, it might be good to sit down with somebody from that group, maybe even you, just, you know, to make it, help make it as informational and well-informed as possible.
But yeah, I think that's great, and I would appreciate.
So if you want to do that, I'm flying up.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we also talked about is changing it from climate survey to a staff engagement survey.
That's I like that. Yeah.
So she said, which is slightly different.
Yeah. But I think we're going to get the same response from either one. It's just climate survey can also be a little confusing. Some don't think they mean.
Right.
Climate change. I mean, I know it sounds silly, but
just getting back to what you're saying, yes, resolution is kind of our only formal power. But you know, and you know, Mary was talking about this too. We're our own body, and we should be putting forth what we think is important and right to do, regardless of what she or anyone else in the leadership thinks we should do, and you know that's how we're representing the people on campus. We're not kind of the support team for university leadership. We're supposed to be representing the people who don't meet with that leadership. So she didn't think that we necessarily needed to at all test the waters with her or with President Gordon.
So how long would it take for us if we try to make this into a resolution?
Well, I would imagine what we would have to do is put something together, right, off of this, which shouldn't take too long. If we wanted to, if we thought we could get that done by next Wednesday and we could get it out to everyone in the EA, we could vote at the next EA meeting. Right?
I said go for it.
Yeah.
I have a meeting with Marnie tomorrow. I can mention it to her, but it wouldn't be as official as you talking to Marnie. Mm-hmm.
But I'm happy to mention it if you want to follow up with Maureen. Okay.
So we can't really vote, but just kind of a straw poll. We want to go in this direction.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks. All right, I'll email it to you and we'll go from there.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. Elections chair, Curtis, are you officially, yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
But I have nothing to report.
We can just talk. Curtis and I and Ari and Amy met Tuesday? No, Monday.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Monday. About election stuff and made some minor modifications to, or Amy made some minor modifications to the calendar and just kind of the guidelines. A couple things that have changed in the past, we used to go to the registrar for your photo if you're running. They're not doing that for us anymore. So Amy will be taking photos
with my brand new camera.
So, you know, mugshots by Amy. We will have, let's see, 13 seats to fill. Right now, what we discussed is, and Ari and Curtis or Amy jump in, that in order to be able to stagger the terms so we don't have 1 year six people turning over, the other year 13 people turning over, that we will have two of the at-large terms and one of the exempt terms be one-year terms, and then everything else is two-year terms. Right? Did I get that right?
Do people then know what they want to run for?
Well, what we had talked about doing is essentially that everyone would run, and based on, so if we have six exempt people run, the top three, because there's four vacancies, the top three seated people will get the two-year terms, and then the fourth person will get the one-year term.
Or if it's had to be appointed.
Right, or if it has to be appointed, the appointment would be for the one-year term kind of thing. One of the things that we're trying to work out is how to deal with the large number of at-large seats, because most people will either run for an endowed seat or a non-endowed seat, so how to seat people at large, because they're not going to think of themselves as at large. I mean, you typically identify with one or another. So I don't know if we really resolved that at all.
We have another meeting, I think.
Yeah, to figure out how.
How many at large seats are there?
There'll be five open at large seats.
Okay. There is a total of six.
But there's a total of six.
Okay.
And one of them right now, Tricia, is in an at large seat.
So
one of the things that we threw on the table is this idea that everyone would run either exempt or non-exempt, and then whoever doesn't get seated in their exempt or non-exempt seats, we would go with the next highest people and put them in the at-large kind of.
Yeah, I don't think we also talked about like sort of the opposite of that,
right,
which would be
everyone.
You rank all of the candidates on one ballot. And we would seat the at-large candidates first, and then we would remove them from the tabulation to do the in-ballot contest.
Oh, I see. Right. So you would cascade the cascading.
So basically, the most popular candidates would get the at-large seats, mm-hmm, because those are the most, should in theory be the most competitive seats. Although this year, because there's so many at-large seats, it may be a little bit, mm-hmm, different.
So that's kind of where we are. With
the election. And that's the changes?
Yes, I'll send it to you.
Okay. Because the press release went out, so.
The only change on the calendar was the deadline.
When materials become available.
The materials becoming available. It was originally March 7th, and we're switching that to February 17th based on the press release.
And the campaigning meeting, we thought would be more appropriate to call them informational meetings instead of campaigning, because you're really gathering information. You're not doing any sort of campaigning at that point.
And if any of you want to come to the communications committee meeting on Friday at noon in B12, we'd be happy to have your input. And Curtis, could you attend? This is what we're going to be talking about.
One of the other things we talked about, was this notion of potentially, and probably not this year, but the year after, making an attendance and election info meeting mandatory, so that we could talk about expectations, what is expected of you when you're on the assembly. And I'm going to be working on some kind of just basic guidelines for, attendance at meetings, participation on committees, so that people have a really good understanding of what it means to run and be on the assembly. We didn't think it was fair to try and make people attend a mandatory meeting this year, so we're going to really encourage people to come, and then we've talked about, as materials get submitted, that if they couldn't come to a meeting, that someone from UTA would get on the phone with them and maybe just take 10 minutes and say, these are kind of the expectations, this is what it's like to be involved, this is the time commitment kind of thing, and just really have that conversation with them before they get seated, so that if they're saying, oh, this is more than what I expected, they can decide not to run, this kind of thing. So
we might want to do something just quickly off the top of my head, and I don't even know if it's allowed or whatever, but like, if you get somebody on the EA and they just don't show up, like, you know, put in a, you know, say you miss three meetings or four meetings, you know, then we can appoint somebody in your place. You know what I mean?
Right.
There should be a way out for on both sides for that member,
right,
and for the committee,
right,
who basically has a non-person, mm-hmm, you know.
And I don't know, Ari, I don't know if there's anything in our charter that speaks to anything like that right now.
I looked for something about it and I couldn't find anything.
But that could be something that we can reinstate into the charter, but I think, you know, at least while we're figuring this out, giving them the expectations, and if they're already sitting here thinking, okay, I don't think I can make meetings.
Somebody just note that, maybe something to talk about as a charter revision.
I don't know. It's, so if it's a, if there's a vacancy, it's basically up to the DA to fill it however it wants to, but like, it doesn't have to be. A person would be automatically seated if in the election for that seat they were a runner-up.
Right. Well, no, I'm just saying when somebody is an EA member, but they just don't show up.
We can't get them to come to the meetings and
they're
not
participating. There should be.
They can be removed by a 2/3 vote.
Okay. No, but there should be, you know.
Right.
An
well, that's why
yeah,
we're talking about an expectations
yeah
list.
Yeah.
Right. So can I add a little bit more about election stuff? I met with Therese O'Connor and with Steve Devlin, who both work with bargaining unit staff, to talk about getting in front of their staff. And I will meet with I'll go to all the dining meetings, and I'll go to all of the campus life facilities meetings, but I can't go to all of the housekeeping meetings across campus. There are about 15. And I was hoping to have a schedule today to pass around and ask you to sign up to attend one. The weather has made it difficult for the facilities and housekeeping staff to have gotten that to me. But I can send it around once I have it. And like I said, I'll have talking points based on the press release and on the conversation that we have tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So, but I can't do them all.
Yeah.
So I really, really, really need your help to take on one or two of them. It would be going to a time clock meeting that would be scheduled that they would know they need to attend. And 5 minutes, you know, just to go and say, this is happening, and answer any questions that they have. So we're not talking about a big chunk of time, but it would just need, you just need to be there. Steve is really excited about this. He's thrilled that we've asked to talk to his staff. So he's going to do everything that he can to make it happen. It's just he's a little behind the eight ball right now in terms of schedule.
Dumb question. Is the staff of hotel staff a bargaining unit?
They probably are, but they're not part. I'm pretty sure they're not part of Steve's staff.
Well, I mean, I just don't even know because, I mean, that would be an interesting
mm-hmm
group to talk to. I don't even know if that's sad or in my family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I guess that would be my homework.
Yes. Okay, good. Those who clean the Statler Hall would
have,
but I and they would be part of these staff.
Right.
Yeah.
What about, I can't remember, we talked about, I know David was in a view and I have somebody too.
Yeah, someone too.
I'll wait to hear. Yeah, you have a talking point. But I assume one of the people we have includes grounds.
I think so.
I don't remember seeing grounds on the list.
I have your list. You've got, it's almost all campus life people on your list. Yeah, there's no grounds. There's nobody from grounds.
That wouldn't be grounds, but
no,
facilities.
But he may know.
Campus life kids, okay. So, let me do grounds.
Should we get a list of all the parking lanes?
We have to table because we're 3 minutes over time. Unless we want to extend our meeting, I don't think there's any desire to do that. No, I see.
Okay.
Well, there's nothing on the thing. In the room. So
okay.
Can be here. Does anybody quickly have anything else to add to this? Election stuff? Any new business?
No. Can I just say really quickly, and we can table this for next meeting, is we got that email about Mike Cornell,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's going, what? Everybody's like, what is this? Like, it's so confusing, the email. You know, if you hadn't heard anything about this at all.
I haven't gotten anything else other than saying Peggy Smith.
I didn't look at it.
I didn't get anything.
I kept it.
I got the thing, Peggy.
Do you want to put up the DVD?
Just a week.
I just got what Peggy forwarded to us that went to the
no,
that's what everybody got.
It should be good to know. That's, it's a soft rollout. It's intended to not be too high profile right now because they're expecting there will be issues.
But maybe we want to have Peggy come here and just talk about it.
Yeah.
So then we can turn around.
And I'm sure she would like to do that, actually.
Do you want to ask Peggy?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I second that.
Cool. Soup and Hope. Do we have an actual date for everybody to go?
Well, Janet Shortall is now no longer overseeing, so I need to connect out. Yeah, actually, as we were sitting here, I think, I'm going to call Catherine and find out who now I've got to connect with because I want to get us at least one date on the calendar. So I'll take care of Catherine and I are getting together. So I'll ask
anything else? No? Anyone want to make a motion to adjourn?
Mercy to adjourn.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Hey, everybody.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.